Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Now and Then by Justin M. Kiska. Read by Joe Hempel. Prologue. Spring, 1981. One by one, he watched from the shadows across the street as the self-important members of the Parker Historical Society's board of directors left the old converted townhouse in the middle of the city's historic district. A waste of a building, he thought to himself, with more than a little contempt. If he'd had his way, it would have been torn down years ago. But nothing ever changed in Parker. The powers that be wouldn't allow it. If the status quo shifted even slightly, there was a chance they could lose their influence and ability to control everything that went on in the town. First to leave, clearly in a rush to get on his way, was Howard Worthington, a tall, distinguished man with whom he'd had the opportunity to speak on many occasions. If he was forced to admit it, Worthington was a decent guy overall. But he was still one of them. As the patriarch of one of the city's founding families and president of South Mountain Bank and Trust, he was nothing more than a stuffed shirt getting rich off the backs of everyone around him. Although he did have excellent taste when it came to cars. Worthington's shiny new Mercedes 280 SL was parked in the small lot next to the building. A mechanical thing of beauty, the cherry-red roadster glistened in the light of the street lamps. What he wouldn't have given to get behind the wheel and take it for a spin. For a moment, enticed by the luxury toy, he almost forgot the reason he was there. He needed to focus and not let himself be distracted. As the little convertible sped off down the street, a few more of Parker's self-proclaimed social elite emerged, chit-chatting about God only knows what. No doubt the conversations were benign and of no real importance in the grand scheme of things. Heaven forbid these important people spend any of their valuable time discussing the city's real problems, instead opting to debate the theme of that year's fundraiser, or how it was beyond necessary to refinish the Wooten cabinet secretary desk that the society purchased the year before for a reported $10,000. The darkened alley provided the perfect vantage point to watch every move these people made, smirking, laughing, thinking they were better than they were. He knew each and every one of them. They all had their dirty little secrets they didn't want anyone to know. But in Parker City, everyone knew everyone else's business. It didn't matter how hard one tried to hide it. There was one thing he knew for certain. People were creatures of habit. Whether an individual following their daily routine or as a group, each person doing what they always did, like a cog in a machine, patterns always emerged. You just had to pay close attention and look for them. That's exactly what he'd been doing. Watching. By doing so, he'd learned a great deal about his subjects. As expected, 15 minutes after the meeting was scheduled to conclude, everyone had left but her. Staying behind after the meeting was part of the routine she always followed. She would be the only person left in the building after the mousy receptionist who greeted everyone with that stupid, toothy smile left. With the front door now locked, the light still burned bright on the third floor where the group had its small office. That's where he would find her. It's time. Go now. The voice constantly in his head was more forceful than ever. It was always there, whispering in his ear and telling him what to do. Over the last few days, the voice had been getting louder and louder. It was becoming unbearable. He had to do this tonight to make it stop. Go now. Checking to see that no one was on the street, he stepped from the shadows, leaving the safety of the alley and its evening camouflage. Even if someone did see him crossing the street, what would it matter? He certainly didn't look suspicious. And quite frankly, anyone he ran into would probably know him and not think twice about seeing him out and about. Everyone in Parker City knew everyone else, which is exactly why it was so difficult to keep secrets. Hiding in plain sight, he quickly made his way across the street. Taking a deep breath, once he reached the sidewalk, he disappeared once again into the shadows that filled the empty parking lot beside the old house. Having sat through a boring history lesson about Parker City once, He remembered the wrinkled old historian standing at the front of the room telling everyone how there used to be another building where the lot was now. It started out as a stable for the household's horse and carriage before it was turned into a garage for the family's fancy new Buick touring car. Eventually, it ended up being used for storage until one hot summer night, a group of students from Hammer Mill College, just north of the city, burned it down while protesting the Vietnam War. It was one of several buildings that had been damaged that night. Luckily, no one had been hurt, but 24 college kids were arrested and brought up on charges after the incident. The backyard, at one time the location of countless garden parties, was now full of weeds and overgrown bushes that needed serious pruning. The only thing that looked remotely tended to was a small footpath from the parking area to a back door. Now an emergency fire exit, it was once the servants' entrance into the kitchen. Filled with file cabinets and dusty boxes, the kitchen had long ago been converted into a storeroom. The latch on the door was old, almost as old as the place itself, and easy to pop with a good hard shove. No bars on the windows, no burglar alarms to worry about going off. This was too easy, he thought to himself with a smile. He quietly eased the door closed behind him. The doorknob dangled in its place, having almost come off in his hand. The entire place smelled old. That was the only way he could describe it. There was something about the smell that forced him to think back on all the times he'd been forced to visit his grandmother. So full of random boxes and bins, he found it difficult to squeeze his way through the storage room. Already anxious, he began to be overtaken by a feeling of claustrophobia. After a few deep breaths, he pressed on and out of the room. Following the empty hallway, he passed room after room filled with antique sofas and chairs, Chippendale sideboards, and paintings by local artists no one would ever hear about outside of Parker. Moonlight provided the only light with which to navigate the first floor. Slowly creeping down the main hall, strange shadows danced across the walls and ceiling around him. They could have been ghosts guiding his path, their eerie shapes pointing the way. He couldn't help but feel as though this were the opening scene of a horror movie or some murder mystery. It was certainly the perfect setting. When it was first built, just a few years before the turn of the century, the house on Braddock Street was one of the most magnificent and certainly most modern in the city. Three stories of polished mahogany hardwood floors, marble fireplaces, electricity in every room, a kitchen with a refrigerator, and a bathroom on each floor made it the envy of almost everyone in town. Almost 100 years later, visitors to the Historical Society were greeted in the foyer by a portrait of the original owners, Theodore and Miriam Garrett. A successful attorney, Theo Garrett had been appointed to the circuit court for the district covering Parker County by Governor Elihu Jackson. He was a fierce jurist whose time on the bench earned him the reputation of being a hanging judge. By the time he retired, he'd sentenced more men to maximum sentences and years of hard labor than the other two judges with whom he served combined. The house had remained in the Garrett family until the judge's great-grandson donated the property to the Parker Historical Society for its permanent home several years earlier. It was now a museum dedicated to the history of the small Western Maryland city. Vivid black-and-white photographs depicting life in Parker City during its earlier days hung on the walls throughout the house. The opening of the first Woolworth 5-and-10-cent store, the groundbreaking of the Harlequin Theater, the parade for troops returning from Europe after World War I, a visit from President Franklin Roosevelt, were all forever frozen in time. Having been through the building on a number of occasions, he was familiar with most of the displays, but tonight was not an educational visit during which he'd be wasting time paying homage to the past. "Don't touch anything." The voice was just as anxious as he was. Starting up the grand staircase to the second floor, he moved slowly to keep the old wooden step from making too much noise. The worn carpet runner masked his footfalls as he climbed the treads, the smell of dust and stale air following his every step. A slight moan from one of the warped boards stopped him dead in his tracks. Frozen, not breathing, he waited to make sure she hadn't heard him. After several tense moments, he allowed himself to relax. The unnerving groan that had stopped his heart hadn't carried upstairs. Or more likely, as with anyone that spent a significant amount of time in the old house, She was probably used to hearing creaks and squeaks and didn't think twice about them. He still had the element of surprise on his side. Be careful. Be quiet. Taking a tentative step, then another and another, he began to climb once again. Counting the steps as he went, he tried to remain focused. Reaching the landing on the second floor, he paused to listen. It was eerily quiet. That only added to the mood. A momentary surge of excitement filled his body. The rooms on the second floor were where the Historical Society's various displays and exhibits were open to visitors. The residents of Parker City and the surrounding county were proud of their home and its heritage. The area had first been settled as a small trading post on the Tasker River in the early 1700s. It hadn't officially become a city until 1785, a mere 2 years before 39 prominent men signed their names to the country's new constitution, some 120 miles away in Philadelphia. With its roots firmly embedded in the early days of America's Republic, combined with its proximity to the nation's capital and the part it had played during the Civil War, history was indelibly and proudly woven into the fabric of Parker. Up and down the hall, dim lights glowed in each room, one of which was the library, where all the official documents and papers had been collected, including tax journals and census records dating back to 1790. Looking through the leather-bound folios, one could trace property ownership, business contracts, and families back to some of the city's earliest days. The pages were yellowed and brittle with age, but the handwriting was still remarkably clear. Having started as a rural community, with farming still a very important part of the local economy, a rift had begun to grow as more commercial and manufacturing businesses began to open. It was a battle that had been fought time and time again. Old versus new, the past versus the future. The small-town community values that gave Parker its character were being engulfed by the encroachment of the Washington suburbs as they spread out in all directions. Parker City, in particular, was turning into a very big, small city. Even as Parker City and County glacially clawed their way into the future, there was an old guard dating back to the days of the original trading post that still held most of the power. Five families were credited with the founding of the city. The Bakers, the Mosses, the Worthingtons, the Tildens, and, of course, the Parkers. If one were to go through all of the documents the society had amassed over the decades, the names of those five families would appear on deeds and transactions generation after generation after generation. Across from the hall in what was once the bedroom of Theo and Miriam's only daughter was a place visitors could see original clothing from different periods in Parker's history. A waistcoat that belonged to Thaddeus Parker, the city's first mayor, hung on a dressmaker's form in a glass display cabinet in the center of the room. The rust-colored vest had been immaculately preserved, as had Thaddeus's pipe, which was displayed in a box on the fireplace mantel next to a little gold plaque. Beside the fireplace hung bullet-riddled jackets from a pair of Civil War uniforms, one from the North and one from the South. The tattered and blood-stained pieces belonged to brothers Joseph and Jeremiah Woodley. One fought and died for the Union, the other for the Confederacy. They were stark reminders that the history the region was built upon was not always pretty and peaceful, but bloody and tragic. A favorite room through which visitors could stroll was the map room. From the first-hand drawn map of the trading post along the Tasker River to the current layout of the city, the growth of Parker could be tracked over the last 191 years. Every major addition of land was recorded and exhibited on large maps along the walls. There was even a rumor that one of the maps from the days of the Civil War, of which the Society housed three, contained hidden clues to the legendary lost Confederate treasure. No one had ever actually uncovered any secret messages or treasure maps, so most people just chalked it up to being an old wives' tale, though there were some old-timers around that swore by the myth. Throughout the house, there were so many remarkable pieces from the past, all of which deserved attention and any of which could be viewed as a doorway to history. None of it was of any interest to him. It was on the third floor where his interest lay. He was there for a reason. There was no more time to waste. The closer he got to the top of the wooden stairs, with all the lights still burning bright on the third floor, the more difficult it became to disappear into the shadows and hide in dark corners. It's time. The narrow stairs opened onto an equally narrow hallway. Covered with many more black and white photos, it was almost impossible to see the sage-green wallpaper which had been recreated to match the design of a cloth covering that once hung on the plaster walls. Pieces of furniture, each with its own story, cluttered the already cramped passage. Staying as close to the wall as possible, it was an obstacle course trying to avoid tripping over any of the antique pieces. At the end of the hall, Theo and Miriam's bedroom had been converted into a conference room, where the board would hold its monthly meetings. The most striking features, certainly Mrs. Garrett's favorites, were the oversized windows looking out on the front of the courthouse across Braddock Street. A small decorative park with rose bushes and a water fountain marked the path for those on their way to court. In the spring, as the flowers bloomed, it made for a beautiful picture. Along with an old wooden conference table and matching chairs, some of the more priceless pieces in the Society's collection were kept in the conference room where they could only be enjoyed by a select few. It was all such bullshit, he thought, passing by the open door, glancing in just to make certain he hadn't miscounted and no one had stayed behind. The sound of shuffling paper was coming from the room next door. That's where she would be, in the office. He could hear her humming something horribly off-tune. A combination of anxiety and excitement brought on by the thought of her just around the corner caused his chest to tighten. He needed to get his breathing under control. Calm down. You can do this. Standing in the doorway, he was finally able to see her. The surprise was going to be better than he imagined. Beverly Baker was standing with her back to the door, next to a small desk in the center of the room. A former beauty queen, Beverly spent hours every morning doing her hair and makeup, selecting the perfect outfit, and picking just the right accessories. Image was everything, and the process was her daily ritual. Other than being a platinum blonde, in no way natural, she bore a striking resemblance to Linda Gray, who had recently risen to fame playing Sue Ellen Ewing on Dallas. Big hair, shoulder pads, and all. It was a comparison Beverly relished. Physically attractive, her personality left quite a bit to be desired. The current matriarch of another of the city's founding families, she'd once been referred to as a viper disguised as a Southern belle. Those words were uttered on more than one occasion by none other than her late father, State Senator Wilson Lee Baker. Like father, like daughter, they both had the ability to be charming and affable, but both commanded and demanded respect and obedience. Senator Baker had been a shrewd negotiator in the halls of the state capitol, but when talking failed, he didn't see a problem using a little blackmail now and again to get what he wanted. It was the Baker family motto, do whatever it takes to achieve your goal. If that meant screwing over someone to get ahead, so be it. It was a lesson he had instilled in his four children from a very early age. Following the senator's sudden death after suffering a massive heart attack, as the eldest child, Beverly had taken over the family's considerable holdings, the vast majority of which were in real estate. According to records in the clerk's office at the courthouse, the Baker family was one of the largest private landowners in the county. As he slid into the room, she had a copy of the day's newspaper open in front of her, reading something she deemed worthy of her precious time. When she finished reading, she closed the paper and tossed it on the desk. With her paper shield gone and nothing distracting her senses any longer, Beverly's body stiffened ever so slightly. Did she know she was being watched? Could she sense him? He wondered what horrible thoughts might be running through her mind at that very moment. He hadn't moved, hadn't made a sound. He was barely breathing. But she knew he was there. If he were able to see his own reflection in a mirror, he would have seen the horrifying grin on his face. It was a combination of pleasure and complete evil. He was reveling in the moment. Hello, Beverly. Chapter 1. Then. The flood several years before had a devastating impact on the city. Rural in its beginning, it had slowly and painfully begun to suburbanize, becoming a bedroom community of the nation's capital. Not even 30,000 people had called Parker City home before the Great Flood. After, the population was even less. The waters had been like an invading army, pushing through the streets, displacing families and literally washing away businesses indiscriminately, leaving much of the oldest parts of the city in ruins. At the heart of the downtown sat the center square of Parker. From the four corners created by the intersection of Commerce and High Streets rose four classic pre-Civil War buildings. When first constructed in the 1800s, shortly before the war, they had been the tallest and most magnificent Parkertons had ever seen. Several architectural historians had even featured the center square and its antebellum structures in their works chronicling the region's design history. For all their original splendor, after the 5 days of heavy rain and thunderstorms finally subsided, the once grand structures found themselves under nearly 4 feet of sludge-like water. 3 years later, a shadow could still be seen on the stone and granite facades from where the water level had remained for days. It didn't matter how many times the buildings had been cleaned. Hints of water damage lingered as a haunting reminder of the devastation Mother Nature had the ability to inflict. Like apparitions never willing to move on to the next world, buildings that once glimmered in the sun sat cold and dark. It was the same story for most of the buildings along the main streets near the Tasker River. Boarded up windows, crumbling exteriors, and a general sense of despair hung in the air along the once bustling commercial corridor. The floodwaters had barely receded before Parker City's mayor, Charlie Oland, publicly committed to a complete restoration and revitalization of the area hit hardest by the storm. He devoted much of his time to the plans, meeting with elected officials at all levels, city, county, and state, to try to convince them to appropriate more tax dollars for recovery programs. Members of Congress even received personal visits in the hope of finding federal funds to help rebuild. There were those that said if sheer will alone was enough to restore what had been lost, then the mayor's would undoubtedly turn things around. Even with his efforts to breathe life back into the devastated streets, the historic downtown area remained a virtual ghost town. There was very little to bring people to the blocks surrounding the Tasker River any longer. The prosperity Ronald Reagan had promised the year before when he was elected to the White House still had major hurdles to clear if things were going to improve. At least, that was the case in Parker City. With the abandoned buildings, dark alleyways, and empty thoroughfares came the crime one would expect in any depressed urban setting. Each evening, as the sun retreated below the horizon, prostitutes took their places on various corners. Gangs of young hoodlums roamed freely, and drug deals were made openly in the streets. Not that many people were around to bear witness. No matter what the mayor and chief of police did, crime continued to be the only viable business downtown. Unable to put an end to the illegal activities, the Parker City Police Department was at least able to contain the illicit goings-on to the crippled blocks bordering the river. It was a small victory, a very small victory, in a much bigger war city officials were losing. Though the center of Parker remained an albatross around the necks of city officials, other areas on the outskirts of the city's limits were showing signs of life and beginning to grow. Housing developments were springing up on the north and west sides of the city. Manufacturing facilities had opened along the southern corridor, producing everything from furniture to machine parts. And a brand new 800,000-square-foot shopping mall was under construction on the east end. Visionaries like Mayor Oland truly believed Parker City could have a prosperous future. Skeptics said that future hinged entirely on the restoration of the downtown. What had become the dismal symbol of the city needed to change before anyone would ever be able to believe in better days to come. Chapter 2. The scene was the same for Ben Winters every morning as he drove his beat-up police cruiser to the Parker City Police Department. What were once busy streets, lined with stores and restaurants, which he remembered from only a few years earlier, were now empty storefronts with plywood covering the windows and graffiti scrawled on the walls. Most days he used to have breakfast at a little diner, the Silver Griddle just off the center square. The place wasn't much to look at, but the home-cooked food was incredible. There was usually a wait just to get a table or for an empty seat at the counter, but it was always worth it. After Ben had his fill of eggs and bacon, he'd grab a cup of coffee to go and walk to the station only a few blocks away. That was before the flood. Nowadays, Ben would drive down the same street, hoping to see any sign that business was returning. But there never was. Day after day, the dire situation never seemed to improve. Everything still looked the way it did the day before. Miserable. On that particular morning, the sun rose on a much cooler than expected spring day. With a crisp breeze blowing in from the mountains to the west, a chill was in the air. On the ground, frost had formed on the grass overnight, turning Jefferson Park into a field of glistening white crystals. It was a beautiful scene, but completely unwanted. The park's signature feature, a broken-down battlement in the middle of an open stretch of land, sat covered with a thin layer of icy dew. The left-behind remnant of the Civil War looked as though it had fallen under the spell of a wicked ice queen. It had been a particularly cold winter, so when the temperature began to rise and everyone turned their clocks forward, no one wanted to look back. Spring had finally arrived. That's what made the cold snap that morning so frustrating. Jefferson Park, the 30-acre expanse in the middle of the city, divided old downtown Parker from the newer sections of the city. It was all very confusing if you hadn't lived in Parker your entire life. Just like residents of Manhattan gave directions using uptown and downtown as opposed to north or south, natives understood the distinction, and those who weren't natives, well, no one really cared what they thought, in Manhattan or Parker City. As the clock on the dashboard rolled over from 5:59 to 6 o'clock, Ben rattled by a deserted Jefferson Park. His patrol car, one of the oldest in the fleet, had taken what felt like an eternity to start that morning. Luckily, his use of that particular vehicle was only temporary, because the department was in the process of transitioning over from the old Plymouths of the 60s to Ford's new Crown Victoria line. As head of the PCPD's new undercover detective squad, consisting of only himself and his partner, he had been promised a brand new unmarked 81 Crown Vic. He'd even gotten to pick the color, a golden tan. Joining the police force right out of college, Benjamin Adam Winters first served as one of the department's 25 uniformed patrolmen. Not being a hotbed of criminal activity, the department didn't have individual specialized divisions like in other, larger cities. Uniformed officers handled all the cases and calls regardless of the severity. One of Ben's very first calls after putting on the badge was to the scene of a robbery at the local Heinz convenience store. The following day, he was called to help an elderly woman get back into her house after she locked herself out when she went to collect her mail. The day after that, he was put on a traffic assignment. Uniformed officers with the Parker City Police did it all. However, shortly after returning from a conference of Mid-Atlantic City mayors, Charlie Oland decided to make some changes. The mayor's grand vision for Parker and its future was beginning to spill over into every aspect of the city's operations and functions. He instructed his police chief to create a detective squad whose purpose would be to act as the department's criminal investigative unit. He wanted Parker City to be on par with its neighbors and didn't want any department to fall behind, whether police, fire, planning, or parks and rec. Mayor Oland was forward-thinking. That was a fact with which no one could argue. Chief of Police Edgar Stanley, on the other hand, was not forward-thinking. He also didn't like politicians interfering in the way in which he ran his department. On more than one occasion, and to the face of more than one mayor, he would say he'd been there long before them and would be there long after. Even though he served at the pleasure of the mayor and city council, no one had ever actually tried to challenge the entrenched chief. The best way to describe Edgar Stanley was as a surly, miserable son of a bitch out of place in his own time. The form of policing he subscribed to was much more in line with that of the New York City police at the turn of the century, when rules could be bent, if not outright broken, to achieve a goal. It was that type of policing which a young Teddy Roosevelt set out to bring to an end when he became police commissioner. Much in the same way Charlie Oland wanted to modernize the PCPD. It wasn't corruption he was fighting so much as breaking the belief that the old ways were the only ways. Stanley liked doing things the old way. His way. If it had worked for the last 25 years, he saw no reason it wouldn't work for the next 25. But the mayor was dead set on the city having its own detective squad. So if appointing a couple of detectives would get the young, idealistic mayor out of his hair, then so be it. He'd put up with worse ideas. After reporting to work one morning 6 months ago, Ben and his partner, Tom...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?